All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Ah, yes, the music fades in the background. Welcome to another edition of Veterans Radio. I'm here with my partner, Dale Thromberry. Dale, hello, man.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Flag Day.
I know, Flag Day.
Flag Day. Get your flags out. Where are the flags?
I got mine out. And, you know, a couple of my neighbors now are starting to fly them.
Mm-hmm.
But they leave them up 24/7. We just had those big storms.
Well, they got to dry out.
I know.
But at least they're, you know, some of them are making the attempt.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to talk about this group right here, the Revolution Flag Group. Revolutionflaggroup.com. Revolutionflaggroup.
Right.
Hey, they have a wonderful package. It's about $35, $40. And everything is, they have some, and if you go to, I can't mention the store, but if you go in certain stores, you know, they got them like for $9.95, and those don't make it. But the one that they sent me, the kit, I think it's like $45, $50. So how do you get a flag here? Well, you go to revolutionflaggroup.com. You can do that. Or you can call. Remember, always have a pencil when you're listening to Veterans Radio, right? Dale?
Right.
Absolutely. 1-866-319-4798. 1-866-319-4798. If you got a flag, fly it today, because we're live, and today is the 14th of June.
It is. It's Flag Day. Get them out there.
But we have the 4th of July coming up, so you can buy a flag between now and then.
You should fly your flag every day.
Every day. But and when we were kids, we had the whole day off for Flag Day because they had a big celebration in grade school. I mean, it was huge. The bands came out, the kids, and we said the Pledge of Allegiance, and the principal said, I mean, that was really cool. And then we sold flags in front of the church. Oh, they went like hotcakes. No, we couldn't even. People were stuffing money in our shorts.
It's really
and
hard,
though,
when Bob was that little, you know, the flag only had about 13 stars or so. So, you know, it was only a little bitty flag.
No, we had, and it was, it. We sold out the couple, we were Boy Scouts. We sold out within 2 hours in front of the church. I mean, hundreds. People were swarming around us to buy them. So I don't see that. What do you think?
That put me on the spot, right? I think that we should, that's one of the things I would like to go back and kind of reinstitute, is the idea of showing your patriotism. Don't be afraid to put your flag out. It represents us. You know?
That's right. It doesn't mean you like Obama or Mitt Romney or anybody.
No, the idea is that there's 50 states that are separate but together. And that's what makes our country so unusual anyway. Think about that, Bob. You know, if you got 50 different states, you got 300 million different people, and somehow we managed to get along pretty well.
Sometimes
we got ups and sometimes we got downs. But for over 200 and some odd years, we're the only democracy out there that is like this.
That's right. And when you think of the Sunnis and the Shiites going at it and ISIS and Taliban, and we don't have that here.
No, we're very fortunate because we are, you know, we try to welcome everybody. There are some exceptions where people don't get along for whatever reason, but I think that the idea of America is still the best thing going. So get your flag out there and show your patriotism there. This is the best country in the world, and you better show it.
That's
or
right.
Or somebody will come and take it away from you.
And to kind of segue into our first guest, we have with us Congresswoman Debbie Dingell from the 12th District here in Michigan, and she's going to be with us in just a moment. We're going to be talking about Selfridge, Dale, and the A-10s. It means a lot to the economy here.
It does. I mean, and the Congress has threatened to do away with these before. And it's
a couple of years ago.
Right, and it's through the efforts of former congressman, mm-hmm. Dingell and
Conyers. John Dingell.
Right, and Conyers and some of the other ones, that they were able to maintain the force of A-10s up there. And now it's passed on to the next Dingell for this cause. But it's important. I mean, you know, Selfridge Air Base provides a lot of employment opportunities. It's up there in Macomb County, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I'm not
a native. It's a beautiful base.
I'm not a native Michigander.
It's
so
right
I,
on.
I just point at fingers.
It's right on one of the five Great Lakes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the duty there has got to be great and all the support personnel. Well, anyway, let's get right to our first guest with us at Veterans Radio for the first time, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell from the 12th District. Debbie, welcome to Veterans Radio and happy Flag Day.
Happy Flag Day to both of you, and it's great to be on with you. And I am flying my flag proudly, and I fly it all the time, by the way.
You know, it just one little aside at the what do I call it? Complex? What the condominiums? They charge $30 to put in the bracket. I said, "What are you doing that for?" Well, you know, we've got our maintenance people. Why don't you just do it? You know, so they kind of even, you know, these are younger people.
Yes.
Congresswoman Dingell, welcome to Veterans Radio. I think we already did that. And now we're going to talk about a few things that are very close to your heart, dear to your heart, and that the information that we want to get out to our listeners. I know I got your email, but I do want to very briefly talk about Selfridge Air Force Base and the A-10s. There's something about the A-10. They offer, you know, the Marines use the Osprey, right? Okay, for close air support. They've had a lot of problems with that because it has the movable wing and they can fly straight or whatever. But the A-10, the Wild Weasel, has been around for a long time. It was originally developed to combat the tanks that the Russians had. It was a tank killer. But since then, it's been close support and a very effective close support. Selfridge Air Force Base has been around for almost 100 years. It's got a large employee base in Macomb County. And just recently, a squadron of A-10s went to fight ISIS. So, you know, folks, here in Michigan, we sent a squadron over there of A-10s from Selfridge. We want to keep the A-10s. Congresswoman Dingell, tell us about that.
Well, I mean, it's obviously very important. First of all, I'm Debbie. I answer to Debbie, and I'm always going to be a Debbie. So please call me Debbie.
You got it.
And Debbie, having said that, Candace Miller, it is in Macomb County, Selfridge Air Force Base. Under the leadership of Candace Miller, is doing a fabulous job of continuing to fight to preserve the A-10 program, which is located at Selfridge. And it continues to provide very unique capabilities for close air support in military combat operations. And as you were just talking about earlier this year, the members of the 127th Wing at Selfridge who operate those A-10s were deployed to the Middle East to help in the fight against ISIS, which is a testament about why it is still very important and effective. So the entire Michigan delegation, Carl Levin and John, did a very good job. But I do want to reemphasize, Candace has really been one of the leaders of this, and it's in her district, and we let the whose district is in be the champion, take the lead, and the importance of it to our state and to the military. And they've tried to retire it before, and before an alternative can provide that same level of close air support for our troops is ready. People thankfully have seen that it's not smart, that it's short-sighted, it's not a smart thing to do, and the entire delegation, in a very bipartisan way, has come together to really fight to make sure that it stays there.
On your estimation, where does the vote stand right now on keeping the A-10?
It's not really clear. It can get pretty complicated. There were dollars included in the appropriations bill we didn't address the saving it specifically in an amendment. There was an A-10 Warthog amendment that would have prohibited the proposed retirement of the A-10 ground support. aircraft in it, but it didn't go. So we're all watching this very, very closely. Senator Peters is working very hard on this as well in the Senate, and we're just being very vigilant and letting the military know very strongly about how opposed we are as an entire bipartisan delegation. And the importance of Selfridge Air Force Base, I think that's one of the things that makes me the craziest, that whenever anybody starts talking about defense and we talk about borders, everybody talks about the southern border, but they don't remember how important the northern border is and how critical it is to our national security. And it's critical that given where we are, the closeness of Canada and those waters, that we keep this kind of strong defense. And right now at Selfridge, we've got about 4,000 full-time civilian and military personnel. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they also contribute hundreds of millions of dollars to the state's economy every year.
Well, we've got our fingers crossed here at Veterans Radio that the A-10 will, and I have to think of the B-52 still flying after how many years.
That's right.
You know, yeah. 50, 60 years. I think that's fantastic. We've had the A-10 for about another, what has that been, about 20 years, I think, we were the Warthog. Was that in Vietnam, Dale?
I don't remember seeing it there, but I, you know, we've been seeing it for many, many years, and until they come up with something better, I think that's the question that Congress has to ask. You know, if you guys haven't come up with something better, why are you
exactly going
to close this down?
Yeah, sounds penny wise and pound foolish.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be staying on that story. Dale and I will be staying current on
great.
That, and Debbie. We'd like to, from time to time, get your input as this budget goes through or not. But now here's something else that you wanted to talk about, something that's very close to your heart, and that is Fisher Houses. Fisher Houses provide lodging for families of veterans who are receiving medical care. I mean, a lot of folks mm-hmm. just don't have a place to go or even close or what. Debbie, why don't you tell us all about that?
Well, this one is very important to me. I think all of us are very committed to ensuring that we take care of the veterans and their families. And we've seen a number of problems in the last couple of years, and I worry about both the John Dingell Hospital and the VA Hospital in Ann Arbor, which are both, the John Dingell Hospital is not in the district, but it has a name on it that makes me feel like it's family. Mm-hmm. And the Ann Arbor Hospital has tremendous staff and doctors that are dedicated to taking care of the veterans, but we need to make sure that our veterans are being taken care of. They don't have to wait. They're getting the medicine that they need. So I want to say that first. But years ago, before I ever knew I was going to run for Congress or be in the Congress, I really spent a lot of time out at Bethesda with the families of returning soldiers, different military that had been injured in the war, and saw how the families were struggling. And that's when I first learned of Fisher House, and when one was built related to Bethesda Hospital, which is now Walter Reed, when they combined the Army and the Navy hospitals together. And in Ann Arbor, you have families coming from all over the state and from other states for treatment. And many times these families don't have a place to stay, they can't afford it, etc. Fisher House has been in business for 25 years. It's a home away from home for the families who are staying and are so critical to supporting our veterans while they're getting the treatment that they need at the hospital. I helped build something similar. I think many of us think about Ronald McDonald House, and mm-hmm. it to help understand what it is that is what it is for veterans. They set up this foundation. We have to raise the money as a community, and then they match it 50%. And once that happens, then the Veterans Administration actually takes over the running of the house. We need one in Ann Arbor. There, you get into game day weekend, or you get into many of the things, there isn't the housing available, and we're taking care of so many people who need it. I really want to build a Fisher House in Ann Arbor.
Well, I think that Fisher House, the whole concept is great. Sometimes folks are brought here on an emergency basis. They don't have time to go out and find a motel room, whatever, and they can just go ahead and put themselves in a nice little safe area and then attend to their to their relative. So I really support. Dale, you have something.
I wanted to ask Debbie a question. Have they already set up the organization that's trying to raise the funds for Fisher House here in Ann Arbor?
Well, no. I've been working with the team there, and I should never have used the word I, because that's how I just feel passionately. But there is a group of us that have been working together, trying to get the foundation in place, understand what's got to be done, what model to use, et cetera. And quite frankly, as I began, I've been talking about this for a long time because I grew so close to the Fisher House at Bethesda, and discovered that there was a very long time in the pipeline because so many people are understanding the importance of this and want to build these for the other veterans' hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to double the amount of money in the appropriations bill this year, so there would be more money in the pipeline to support the Fisher Houses. I'm hoping that we can get, I've had some wonderful support. Everybody I talk to about this is very supportive. We've got a team that is trying to really get the detail down. The community response has been great, and hopefully we'll really get this launched in the next few months of trying to get this done.
Well, we'd like you to keep us posted on that. We'll put it out over the air, that's for sure.
That would be wonderful.
Well, thank you for letting us know and giving us a head. I think that's kind of a scoop, isn't it, Dale?
I talked about it on the House floor last week, which is, I think, why they wanted me to talk to you all about it. It's a very much a community project.
Absolutely. It is. It's a huge community project that we need to commit to. And as Bob just mentioned, please keep us informed as to anything that you need that we can help out with. We'd be more than happy to.
Well, probably $100,000 would help.
Right.
I'd love it, you guys. I'll take it. You know, can I say something else right now, though, too, as we're talking about the veterans and supporting them? One of the things that I tell people is we've started downriver, a veterans task force group with the mayors of the different communities, and have been trying to address a number of the problems. And all of us want to help veterans and their families. People should just think about lending a hand. If someone stays overseas and they're in the reserves, ask them if they just need a light bulb changed, or a mother if she needs a break. Sometimes we're afraid to ask or don't think that we can help someone or make a difference. And you'd be surprised how easy it is to help someone and give them that helpful hand.
And the Fisher House is nonpartisan, folks. We're just all veterans.
Oh, totally.
That's right. We're veterans helping veterans. Debbie, I wanted to get to Valentine's for Veterans. Can't do it right now, but I'd like to have you please come back on either the 21st or the 28th, maybe, Dale, tell us about the Valentine's for Veterans, which is Smiles, actually. It's Smiles.
It's now become Smiles because it's a year-round program because of the success of it, and I would love to do that.
Oh, okay. Good. Then we want to...
We've got your number.
That's right.
You have my number.
Would you give the website for the Fisher House, please?
I do not have that website. We don't have one up and running yet for you all. You can Google Fisher House and you'll see the national program. We don't have the Ann Arbor House one up yet.
Okay. We want to thank you very much for being on the program on a Sunday, taking time out, which I'm sure is your family afternoon. Please say hello to John.
He sends his best to both of you.
And he was on our very first program.
Yes, he was. Very first program.
2003.
That's right. And I interviewed him in a rainstorm on the air in a car. He was in the front seat, I was in the back seat. Boy, and because he was always there for the vet. He was always there for the interview. He never, I'm too busy. He has never had that. Debbie, thank you very much for being on the program. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much to both of you. Take care.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay, let's go to this break right now, right, Derek? And then we'll be back with Jay Barbary, NBC space correspondent. I can't wait. Go ahead, right after this message. Bow. Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online truetoblue.com/military. Yeah, we're back on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould and Dale Throneberry. We're here Sunday as we come by every Sunday live at 1700 hours right here on WAAM. in the garden spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we're going to our first guest and back for a second time on Veterans Radio. And Dale, you know, his book came out in hardcover a few months back, but now it's in paperback. And I want to say it's St. Martin's Press, folks. Remember, always have your pencil handy. St. Martin's Press. It's the title of the book is Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight, but it's more than that. It's more than that. And our next guest, Jay Barbary, NBC award-winning correspondent, was in attendance for all 166 space flights. Wow, what a record! And he broke the case of the Challenger accident, and he's still working for NBC today. So let's give a big Veterans Radio welcome to Jay Barbary, NBC correspondent. Jay, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Bob. And I just want to say up front here, you know, you were throwing a little accolades my way there, but, you know, I'm real proud of the fact that I'm a career and war veteran, and you're talking to the hero of Illinois, the neighboring state down there. And I just want, for the record, you guys can check this, but I flew F-86 fighter jets out of Scott Air Force Base in Belleville, Illinois. And if you check the record, you'll find I did not let one Chinese MiG or Russian MiG get east of the Mississippi. I just wanted you guys to know my record. Okay.
Well, we're going to put that down. That's for sure. We're going to have you on for the whole second half. In just a few minutes, we're going to our news break at the halfway. But we can take this time to talk about Jack King, NASA's voice of Apollo. He recently passed. Did you know Jack well?
Oh, my Lord. Jack was the first person I met here, Bob, when I came here. He came here like in February of 1958, and I came in April of 1958. He was with the Associated Press, and we've been friends ever since. And, yes, we lost him this past week, the voice of Apollo. And after serving as the Associated Press correspondent from 58 up until about 60, well, actually it was 59, he left and went to a missile magazine, and that didn't go. And from there, he went to NASA and became NASA Public Affairs. In fact, he was the first resident chief of information for NASA here, and he came back and he did all the Mercury programs, Gemini programs, and a lot of people that are old as I am will remember John Shorty Powers. They call him the eighth astronaut, lieutenant colonel. He was the guy in Mercury Control in Gemini. But after he left, then Jack went in there, and Jack did the Apollo. Of course, he did Apollo 11, and I describe it in the book, Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight. He's telling what Neil is saying, and he was just singing. He was moving through this so smooth, the old countdown going to 9:32 a.m. on July the 16th, 1969, and he's been heard all over the world by more than a billion people. And, yeah, we lost him at the age of 84 here this past week, and he was just a wonderful person, left a wonderful family, and had a wonderful history in the space program.
You know, folks, this is going back to those days that We had so much trust in the Jay Barbarys and the Jack Kings and the Walter Cronkites. What these people said, we paid attention to. I mean, they were the, you boys were well, the, were the, you guys were it. You had everything. How did you handle all that?
Well, the thing is, Bob, that, you know, we were first taught in journalism, broadcast journalism, you know, get it right. Yeah, I tried to be quick, but I tried to get it right. So did Jack, and so did Walter, of course. Yeah, Walter was just a wonderful guy, even though he was with another network, and, you know, and he was so nice, a relationship with him. In fact, he endorsed my books, gave me excerpts on the outside of them and everything, going back to Moonshot, going back to for Alan Shepard that we did that was a New York Times bestseller, as was Neil Armstrong's book. I've had the great pleasure of having two New York Times bestsellers now. No one should be that lucky, especially a fourth grade educated clown from the farms of South Georgia. You know, I keep telling everybody that, and they say, you know, I got to the fourth grade in Georgia, you know, and then I said, what you guys don't understand in Georgia, the fourth grade is high school. You know, but one of my best friends, that are lifelong friends, I work with in Albany, Georgia, Channel 10, before I went to work for NBC, is John Rivard, and he's probably about 30 miles from you guys right now. He's there in southeast Michigan between Toledo and Detroit.
That's
and,
where we are.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and,
we're
and,
really
and he's right on a farm, so he's right around there somewhere, and I talked to him, you know, just a few months ago, and he was still going great on the farm sitting up there, but he and I started out. He came down here. He worked on the range down on Grand Bahama Island and everything, putting the missiles up and everything. But I don't know why I got off on that. But the people, you know, unfortunately, they're all leaving us now. They're going ahead. And after Neil died on back in August of 2012, John Glenn had been down here with Neil. Neil and John and I were pretty close, and he'd heard us talking about doing this book, and it was hard to get Neil to sit down and talk about himself. He wanted to talk about other people. He always felt like any of the astronauts could have done the job he did. He wasn't anything special. But anyway, we kept talking about doing this book, and this is not a biography. My God, I keep telling reviewers it is not a biography. James Hansen, I think his name is, did one called First Man. Now, that's a biography. If you wanted to know if Neil Armstrong's a great uncle in Germany had a wart on his nose, read that book. You know, it's
okay.
That detail. But this is about his life of flight.
We got to get to the news. We'll be right back and listen to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio, Dale Thronberry and myself, Bob Gould, and talking right now with NBC award-winning correspondent Jay Barbary, the man who was giving us all the information on the astronaut flights. And we're, tell you the truth, we're actually out there and marketing his book. It's St. Martin's Press, folks. It's Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight. Look, you want something to read this summer? Okay. You know those garden variety paperbacks are these little things that you got to bend them and you can't read what's in the inside of the scene. Well, this is different. It looks like a missile. I'm talking about a religious missile because it's nice and it's got, you can actually open the darn thing up and read it without having to push it and scrunch it and do all that other business. Plenty of good pictures. So if you want, we got Father's Day. Oh, Father's Day next week.
Sunday.
Oh, wow. We ought to sell 100,000 of the Neil. Okay, right. Remember the paper, folks. Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight. St. Martin's Press. You're going to want to get that. Here we go. Okay. Jay, I got so much I want to talk to you about. You know, The Right Stuff. The movie The Right Stuff. I love that. I liked, I also read the book, and these guys, they really had it. All of them. And they were military guys. There were no civilians. Scott Crossfield was one that came to my mind, who was one of the big test pilots. He didn't make it. They used military guys. As far as I know, they used mostly Navy guys. And I want to think the reason for that is because they could land their ship on a carrier. They can take their airplane, land on a carrier. Tell us all about the selection, Jay.
Yeah. Well, you're right on a couple of things there, Bob. And being Navy, you got to remember that the chief executive of the United States then was a guy by the name of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was, of course, Navy, a PT boat commander.
Oh, that had something to do with it.
So,
yeah.
So they always thought that there was a little influence in there. However, there was three on the original Mercury, three Navy, three Air Force, and a Marine being John Glenn. So that made up your seven. Now, they could have had Neil Armstrong in there had he applied, because he was flying the X-15, the rocket plane, and as a civilian pilot for the old NACA, which was the forerunner to NASA. And so he worked for these guys, flew for these guys out at Edwards Air Force Base that became the guys that ran Project Mercury, Chris Kraft and Robert Gilruth and those guys. And they really wanted Neil in there because he was considered probably the best guy around, quickest hands in a cockpit, and quick decisions in order to take care of emergency situations. Because Neil used to say, everybody should train and retrain and train and train and get ready to do what they have to do. He says, but the one thing you can't train for is the unexpected. And he proved that several times. He had, after going up in Gemini 8 and becoming the first astronaut to dock with another vehicle, the Atlas Agena up there, which was one of the giant steps in order to get us to the moon in Project Apollo, that's when, at the point that we stepped ahead of the Russians, Bob. Before then, we were behind the Russians. But 30 minutes after he was linked up with the Agena, one of the rocket thrusters on the Gemini 8 spacecraft stuck, started spinning them rapidly 400 times a minute. They were about to pass out there, being Dave Scott on board with Neil Armstrong. And he made the decision to blow his second control rocket ring, which was not to be used until he was coming back in, but he had to do it. He knew he had to get the spacecraft under control, otherwise he was going to pass out and they'd be dead. So that was his only shot. He got it under control. They had to come down immediately. They had to land in an emergency landing area 500 miles from Okinawa. Wasn't any ships around, wasn't anything. They had one ship going, but that's what they had to do, and they had to come in over China with no contact of Earth. And that was one of the most fantastic maneuvers ever pulled off in rescues in the Gemini program. And it only showed what Neil could do. He ejected from the bedstead training aircraft to land on the moon out there and, saved his life. He was on a split-second decision then. So Chris Kraft and Robert Gilruth and those guys, and especially Deke Slayton, the chief astronaut, told me this out of his own mouth, that they really wanted Neil to be the first landing on the moon, and they were very satisfied to have Pete Conrad to be number on Apollo 12 coming in behind in case Neil didn't make it. And, of course, President Nixon told Neil, hey, Neil, don't take a chance, because if you don't make it, come back. I'll make sure you get another flight. So, anyway, this was all set up, but Neil would never believe it. Neil thought that he just got the luck of the draw to get there. But it wasn't just the luck of the draw. Everybody was happy he was in line to be the first guy to touch down on the moon. All of this is covered in the book, Bob.
Oh, I know. And that's, in fact, that was my next comment. And I have the book right in front of me. Again, folks, it's easy reading. Not that the prose is easy, but it's just so well printed here. And it's going to make a great Father's Day gift for whom. How, Jay, did you... You knew these guys. How did your heart take all these flights? How did you control? How did you control your emotions?
Hey,
do you have a duodenal ulcer now? Tell us about that.
Yeah, people always ask me. Said, was Apollo 11 landing? Was that your most dramatic moment? That you were sitting on pins and needles? No. My most dramatic moment sitting on pins and needles was when that Atlas Mercury lifted off with my friend John Glenn taking him in the first orbit flown by an American astronaut, because that thing blew up just as often as it flew. And here's John Glenn sitting on top of it, riding it into orbit. And John's one of my dearest friends. And if you notice, John does the foreword on this book, Neil Armstrong's The Life of Flight. He was very instrumental in talking me into going ahead and writing the book after Neil died. And so anyway, John, I just want to say to everybody, wish him a happy birthday, July 14th. God bless him. He's going to be 94 years old.
Oh.
He's living up in Columbus, Ohio. They're setting up a university, John Glenn University, after him there at Ohio State University. Of course, they renamed the Lewis Research Center in Cleveland after him. It's John Glenn's Space Center up there. And he's going to be 94. He's the last of the Mercury 7 astronauts, surviving Mercury 7 astronauts. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry, Bob.
No, no, that's all right. And I do want to clear one thing up, folks, because way back when it was said, right after the moon landing and the astronauts came back to Earth, it was a few months later, there was a lot of controversy from some folks. And I remember this. I remember hearing this. And your book cleared it up. Your book cleared it up, which it's been sitting in my skull for about 40 years, 50 years. It was the fact that and it's not true, but that Neil Armstrong pulled rank, that it was supposed to be Buzz Aldrin first, not Neil Armstrong. Well, that was, none of that was true, because in the book, Jay talks about the reason was because where the controls were on the Apollo spacecraft, Buzz would have had to crawl over Neil Armstrong to get out the door to be there. That just wasn't going to happen.
Be a little
difficult. Tell us about that, Jay.
All right. Well, it's in there, but listen, folks, Neil never lobbied for that. He never lobbied once for it. They put a group on it out in Houston at the Manned Spacecraft Center, and they looked and studied all the reasons. You have to remember, Buzz Aldrin was a lunar module pilot. On board the command module pilot, Apollo 11, was Mike, and then you had Neil as a commander. Well, now, Buzz had to monitor everything on board that lunar module, and it had to be safe. And they wanted him watching everything closely when that man went outside and went down that ladder, because if they had to get him back in a hurry, Buzz's fingers would be moving real fast, getting everything ready to lift off to save the situation. So all of those things were in consideration. So they came up, plus the fact Neil happened to be by the door. The commander, he'd go out the door, then that'd leave room for the lunar pilot on the other side to come across and get out the door too, you know. So it was so simple things, and, you know, you'll never get Buzz to say that to you, and there was never any controversy between Buzz and Neil about this, because Neil, you know, they talked about it. They told me one time, and that they decided that Neil says, let's let the group that's studying this, let whatever they come up with, we'll do. And that's exactly what they did. They didn't lobby to go out there and do that. There's been all kinds of stories about Buzz Aldrin's father, who was a very pushy person that was, you know, and a big executive and all, told him he should just get out first anyway. Well, no, it never happened. These people, I don't know where they dreamed these things up. And another one along that line that we clarify in this book is the fact that they said, there's only one picture of Neil Armstrong on the moon because Buzz Aldrin was so jealous that he stepped out first. Buzz Aldrin wouldn't take a picture of him. Wasn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Well, the fact is, they had one camera swung around their neck, and that was to shoot all these pictures. Neil Armstrong had it because Buzz Aldrin was busy setting up the experiments. He's the scientist of it. He was MIT PhD, you know, as well as a test pilot and all of this stuff. So he's doing all the work for the scientists. At the end of their walk out there, Neil handed Buzz the camera, and for about 10 minutes, Buzz got to shoot some pictures, and he shot a great picture of Neil loading rocks on the conveyor belt going up aboard Eagle. And that's on the book. That's on the book cover.
I know.
You'll see Neil standing there loading rocks. Well, that picture was shot by Buzz, but he had 10 minutes. Neil had 4 hours. And when I told Neil that rumor was out there, he just looked at me wide-eyed. He says, boy, what am I going to come up with next?
Jay,
go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry.
No, but what I love about your book is all these little minutiae, all the little details that we didn't know about. There was one, folks, Neil Armstrong, such a skilled pilot, and with the lunar lander, and he had thousands of training trips. We won't even get into all that, because he had to take over the controls. The computers were overloaded. We have more computer generation in your watch than they did, right? I mean, what you got? And he was so skilled. Now think of this: they're going on the moon. This is Magellan. This is the biggest thing since Magellan. And he is Magellan. He's going to another planet. He's flying the bloody thing. He's looking for a flat place to land, and he did it so...
Looking for a parking space.
And
yeah, go ahead.
But he did it so gently that when by the time he came down the ladder, hours later after he landed, there was a 3.5-foot drop. The legs didn't collapse because the probes didn't stick into the moon, folks, because he set it down so gently.
It was
gently.
A soft landing.
Right.
A very soft landing. It was, they expected a hard landing and it would collapse. The pads, landing pads, which would stay, they stayed on the moon in the descent stage, and Neil would be much closer to the moon, but he landed them so soft. And when he shut the engines down, he had 16 seconds of fuel left.
And I got a feeling he didn't...
Yeah, and they followed the path predetermined by the computers, and all of a sudden they're going into a bunch of rocks and everything else, and Neil had to take over, and he skirted across the landscape of the moon. He got to a smooth place, and Buzz was calling out the numbers, and then he set it down.
Now,
and that's why Charlie Duke in Mission Control said we were about to turn blue because they were watching the fuel. He didn't have any fuel left. He was down to 16 seconds. But Neil knew that.
And
he knew exactly where he was, and he was as calm as a cucumber, and he always was.
That's why
they wanted him doing the first one.
There is gravity on the moon. It's not like Earth, but there is gravity. So if he would have shut down the engines for lack of fuel, they would have crashed, number one. But number two was that he started to come down the ladder, and they realized they had that 3.5-foot drop. And, well, but folks, think, you're on the moon. How? You're not going to get, you can't, you got gravity there. You're not going to jump.
You weigh 40 pounds.
You're not
going to. you're 160, 180, you weigh 1/6, so figure it out, you know. And that's what you're talking about. And that was another thing. They were, all of them were turning blue because here he is skirting across about, 30 or 40 feet up. By trying to find a place to land, and he told me, grinned afterwards, he says, what they were thinking about, and I knew, if I ran out of fuel, it would just, drop to the surface, and at 1/6 the gravity, it's not going to crash like you dropped something 30 feet on the Earth. It's like you dropped something 5 feet on the Earth.
Well, you certainly described it so well and so intriguingly in your book, and I love that whole section of the actual landing. And here was something else, folks. I remember the moon land. I mean, we all did. There were billions of people all over the world. We were all one at one point in the history of the Earth. We were all one at that moment. All of us were one. And there it was, live, black and white, live. And there was, and there was Jay Barbary, and there was Jack King. I mean, breathless, folks, and I want Jay to comment on this because right as they landed, we were switching channels and Walter Cronkite was on and they were talking about, and now they're gonna rest. They're gonna take a nap. My mother went, that is so great. That they're gonna let them and oh no, they were trying to fix the computer. Tell us about that, Jay.
No, well, we were on live. Of course, we had the 16 net worldwide network thing, and we were lucky enough. We got the Emmy. Our team got the Emmy for the landing on the moon afterwards. And you're talking about our good buddy Walter Cronkite. Wallace Schirra kept talking to him, saying Wallace Schirra, one of the Mercury 7 astronauts, is on with him. And he kept saying, "What are we going to say when they touch down? What are we going to say on the air? We got to have something, outstanding to say that was magnificent. It'll be historical." And Walter says, "Don't worry about it. It'll come naturally. We'll do it." And when they sat down on the moon, the camera's on Cronkite, and Cronkite said,
Who was the funniest and jokester of all the astronauts?
Oh, my God. Neil Armstrong had a sense of humor, British-type humor, that was unbelievable. But people never saw that of him. But Wally Schirra was probably the biggest jokester. He was always pulling something. So was Gordo Cooper, and they were pulling it on one another. And we got stories in there that they pull on one another that we won't get into. For example, when John Glenn and Neil Armstrong went through jungle training together in Panama, they had all the astronauts lined up on this river in the Chaco Reservation down there, and they had to float down this river to a place, a landing where the helicopters was going to pick them up, and they just had their life vest on, and they're floating down this river. Well, piranhas are not that far north. You see, they don't get up into Central America that far north. But most people didn't know that, but Neil knew it. And I mean, being such a science guy. And so as they're going down this river, all these astronauts, there was a big fuss going on over on one side of the river, a bunch of people, you know, fish splashing around and whatnot, you know, and John calls to Neil and says, "Hey, Neil, what's all that commotion over there?" And Neil looked back, he said, "Oh, but the whole school of piranhas is eating something over there, you know." Well, every astronaut on that side of the river swam back across just as fast as they could. Then all the way down, they're talking about, "You look out for piranhas, you know."
We're talking with Jay Barbary, the author of Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight. Father's Day is coming up for that veteran. Well, even that non-veteran, too, because you're going to love this. I just love the way St. Martin's Press has made this a paperback. It's definitely something you can take with you and read. It doesn't, well, anyway, it's great. And a couple more things. We've only got about 7-8 minutes to go. So when you talked about Neil Armstrong and the other astronauts, and I want to think to myself, because they quarantine these guys. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'd do that too. You never know what microbe or bacteria. But Neil Armstrong thought it wasn't necessary. Quoting in your book, didn't he say he thought it was a slight stupid? Is that
the truth? Yes, he did.
And, why
and
would
so
he think
did most
that?
Of them. So did Alan Shepard and the rest of them. But they had to go through this sort of like the politically correct thing to do. Nobody thought they were bringing us back, but they had to stay in quarantine out there in Houston. And then Apollo 14 was the last one to do it. 15, 16, and 17 didn't do it. But Apollo 11, 12, and of course 13 didn't do it. They didn't land. And 14. So they had three landings that they did it on after that. But Neil, you know, had so much fun in doing that. His mother, for example, he got his mother on the phone the first time after he landed out there, and she's a wonderful woman and, you know, very Christian and prayed the whole time for Neil and everything. And he was talking to her, and she says, "Well, son, are you all right?" And he's telling her, "Yes, sir." And he says, "But Mom," he says, "I can't get my spacesuit clean." He says, "I can't get all the dust off the suit. It's just terrible, you know." Well, that suit had already gone to the Smithsonian, you know, and he wasn't going to clean that suit. They weren't even going to let him do it. And she said, "Honey, you bring that suit on up here. Your mama will clean it for you."
Get that, folks. She was going to clean his space suit. And you brought that up in your book. There was a couple of other just little anecdotal stuff that I just love. When they were in the ticker tape parade in New York. Oh, that's so wonderful.
Wouldn't I
like that? No, they were getting pummeled by key punch cards that they were throwing out the windows, were hitting them like bricks. Tell us about that.
Well, they threw them out, it still wrapped up in bundles, and the wrappers didn't come off. So those, you know, cards would come down and be about as thick as a double brick, you know, and tied, and they'd get hit with that, and they had bruises all over them, you know, when they left out of that, see. But, you know, another real fast little joke here showing Neil, he walked in one morning, into the astronaut, offices at Houston. And his colleague that flew with him on Gemini 8 looked at him as he came in one morning, Dave Scott, and he says, "Good morning, Neil." He says, "I went past your house last night." Neil didn't even look up and says, "Thank you."
In other words, don't Thanks for not stopping in. I love it. I love it. I love it. And I love the way that you, I love the way you write. You write, well, we're in the same generation, Dale, Jay and myself. We're in the same generation. And there was one little small, and I think I can say this on the air, right, Dale? I mean, I don't know what you're going to say. No,
well,
I'm going to.
We've got a delay.
Well, he was talking about.
Go ahead, Bob. What are they going to do to you?
Well,
draft me. Send me to Vietnam again.
I'm thinking about my memory. The guy who was the controller with the short hair and the vest.
Yeah, Gene Kranz.
Yeah, Gene Kranz.
Yeah.
And the way I wish I could find it right at this moment in the book, but you said the way you described it, he had given the finger to traditional. I mean, what a way, and that's the
way he described the current dress of that day when Apollo was, you know, long beards and long hair and all of this stuff, and he was still G.I., the G.I. haircut, you know, and he had this vest and everything like that, and he never went for any of that stuff. Of course, that's all passé today. It all changes, you know, constantly.
But
and he just never changed, and that's the way Gene Kranz was, and he was just the greatest, mission controller to land them on the moon. They couldn't have done better. Could not have done better than have Gene Kranz there and to have Neil Armstrong step on the moon. That was a great combo.
Folks, there was using that phrase, give the finger to, was not derogatory like it is today. It actually meant disregard. Oh, yeah. But you captured that. And when I read that, I hadn't heard that phrase in 60 years, 70 years.
Yeah.
And I'm looking.
Well, we're the same generation, as you say. But I think
most
of them do.
To describe Gene Kranz. Okay, we've got 3 minutes to go here. Dale, do you have something to comment, being Flag Day and having Jay Barbary?
Well, we have
a
nice picture of the flag on the moon that they took up there.
Which is fell down when they took off.
Well, I sure did, because they never got it through that crust. They were, where they tried to get it in, it was like you go down 2 inches and you're going through concrete, you know.
Right.
So they had trouble raising it. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But here's some more of the minutiae, folks. One of the first things that Neil did when he and Buzz were now on the moon was to authentication sample. There was another term you used. In other words, to prove that they were there.
Contingency sample.
Yeah.
Well, see, that was what it was when he got out there. That was his first duty when he went down the stairs. When he got on the moon, he was supposed to have reached down right then, grabbed a handful of moon dust, and put it in a pocket in his suit in case all of a sudden they had a problem and he had to hurry back and get on the limb and they had to take off. Mm-hmm. And that's why Buzz Aldrin was still there at the controls, you know, and he'd get away from all of this stuff about, he was supposed to be first and they changed it. They didn't change anything. You know, this just the way it happened and is the way it should be, and it's the way they did it, you know. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, you have the last word on your book. We've got less than just a little over a minute to go. You get the last word on the book. What do you want to say to our listeners,
Well,
Jay?
Bob, I want to say, yes, it's out in trade paperback now, which is the bigger version of the paperback. It is still out in hardback copy. If you want a collector's, I suggest the hardback copy. You also, you're into electronic books. You can get an electronic book on this. So the book's doing real well. It's in its fourth printing. It is in 77 countries. It's Macmillan, who is the world's largest publisher. And as you know, St. Martin's Press is the imprint in this country of Macmillan. It's doing real great in Australia, everywhere, all over. So we couldn't be happier. It went to number 7 on the New York Times list. And it was as Moonshot, the book of Alan Shepard that I wrote in 1994. It went to number 4 on New York Times. But we couldn't be prouder. And we tried to do the best job and tell you who Neil Armstrong was and the kind of guy he was. It's not a biography. It's his story of flight told by a guy who was there.
We got to go. So We're going to have you back, Jay. Thank you very much for being our...
Anytime, Bob. Anytime. I'm right here for you.
God bless you. Wow.
There you go.
There we go. 6 seconds, 5. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Until next week, you are dismissed.